Got it? Okay, we're ready, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
All right. John, are we running?
Yep.
Okay. We're going to resume our meeting, everybody. Agenda item 19, discussion regarding technical services available to the agriculture industry and potential solutions to water quality problems. Mr. Briggs.
I will in turn turn it over to Michael Thomas for a brief introduction.
Yep. So I just wanted to mention very briefly, we have a couple of speakers here today that I'll introduce in a minute. I just wanted to, again, just like the last item, this is just context for the board. And I wanted to point out the services that are available to the ag industry as we go through this process of renewing the ag order and then implementing the ag order. There are many, many organizations that currently exist that are helping out the industry. The resource conservation districts, Natural Resource Conservation Service, Crop Advisors, Strawberry Commission, USDA, U.S. Department of Food and Ag, California Department of Food and Ag, technical consultants, UC Extension and all the research that they do, sustainability organizations like Cal Poly, organizations like the Wild Farm Alliance, the American Farmland Trust. By the way, the American Farmland Trust had this interesting program in place just recently, which was a BMP challenge, a best management practice challenge, where they were making funds available to growers to implement best management practices, and they were covering the cost if those practices resulted in a loss in crop yield. And that is a national organization. There's conservation organizations like the Nature Conservancy and our local Land Conservancy. They often work with the ag community to do conservation-type work. And then there are the water districts and the funding that they provide and the helping to improve practices and conserve water and reduce nitrate loading. And the Monterey County Water Resources Agency has several programs like that in place. So this was just to have a discussion about the services that are available to the ag industry, to point out to the board for context that this infrastructure does exist, and it goes in line, hand-in-hand with the funding that we were talking about in the last item. And we also invited a couple of people to talk to the board today. One is Murray Einerson. He's a principal hydrogeologist with AMEC Geomatrix Company. They're a consulting company worldwide consulting company, and they do lots of work on investigation and cleanup and treatment of water quality problems. So Murray will be talking about some potential treatment methods for ag water quality issues. And then we'll hear from Keith Backman. He's a consultant manager with Delavelle Laboratory. They have offices in Fresno, Hanford, Paso Robles, and Davis. And he'll be talking about the nitrate issue. I haven't seen his presentation. Actually, he doesn't have a PowerPoint presentation. He's going to be talking to you today about the issue and some potential solutions. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Einerson.
And for everyone's expectations, we've allocated 15 minutes per presenter here.
I'll make sure I stick to that. Thank you very much for inviting me to share with you some thoughts and ideas on some emerging low-cost technologies for treating nitrate in ground and surface water. And I've worked much of my career for industrial clients, Fortune 500 clients, in the last 30 years, and we've tried lots of different things, and not all of them have been successful, but we've learned a lot about the subsurface environment and how to characterize the environment, soil and water, and also to remediate contaminants in the subsurface and in surface water. So it's, I think, very important that we learn from our experiences there and apply them to this environment, to the agricultural setting, and especially to develop lower-cost technologies for treating these contaminants, because unlike some of the Fortune 500 companies, there really aren't the deep pockets that exist in some of the industrial sectors. A graphical example nearby, near the community of Guadalupe, is the Oso Flaco Lake, and it's a visual example of nitrate contamination and some of the impacts that are visible. And nitrate can be released in an organic form in the from human and animal wastes, but also in an inorganic form from the application of inorganic fertilizers. And if the water that comes in contact with the nitrate is carbon-starved, the nitrate is persistent along the flow path and then can discharge either to water supply wells or to surface water bodies like this. It's a nutrient, so it stimulates the growth of algae and some kinds of bacteria, resulting in algal blooms like this, which, depending on your perspective, might be attractive, but the harmful part is that they consume the oxygen and have a detrimental impact on aquatic life. And we've all seen figures like this from the Central Coast showing areas where groundwater has been impacted by nitrate and surface water also. The point I'd like to make is that we can improve our application methods and our management practices today and really dramatically reduce perhaps the amount of nitrate loading, but there's still a lot of nitrate that's in the system. And in surface water, it is removed from the system. It's flushed through the system in a pretty short amount of time compared to the groundwater environment. So even if we treat and reduce the loading to groundwater today, there's still years or even decades where there's probably going to be some treatment necessary at the point of exposure or point of discharge. So what I want to talk about mostly is economical ways to try to treat nitrate right near the point of exposure or near the near the interface between maybe groundwater and surface water, because even if we're successful in reducing the application rates right now, there's still a need for years or possibly decades of treatment, and that needs to be economical. We're not alone in California. This is an issue that we're facing in the rest of the country. This is a paper from the New York Times just describing the problems with algae in Cape Cod and Chesapeake Bay. We have similar problems in Florida and in the Gulf Coast. In these coastal environments, for example, Cape Cod, the nitrate is primarily organic from septic tanks and septic systems. But in the mid-continent regions, in the Midwest and in Canada, a lot of the nitrate is a result of the application of inorganic fertilizers. But in both of these types of systems, economical long-term treatment is really needed. So you can inject fluids, organic materials into the subsurface, and you can mix them, and there are lots of engineering solutions that could be applied, but the trick is to have solutions that are low maintenance and low cost. Pumps, injections, that all costs money. It's O&M, it requires power. And so there are a group of scientists and engineers who've been really trying to think about the simplest way and the lowest cost ways to create long-term treatment of nitrate. And a group in Canada, in the province of Ontario, is really taking some leadership in this. And they've done a lot of testing and actually some full-scale systems where they use wood chips as the carbon source that slowly dissolve over a period of years to decades and react with the nitrate to produce inert nitrogen gas. The real advantage of this is that there are no pumps, there's no electricity needed. The wood chips degrade very slowly over a period that is approximately commensurate with the need for treatment. And I'll just show you an example of one of these sites in southwestern Ontario. And this can be applied in the surface water environment or in groundwater systems. This one I'll show you right now is for treating water that's in a drainage that's received tailwater from an agricultural field. And this is just a profile along the stream axis. So the stream water is flowing from here in this direction. And what they've done is just excavated some of the sediments down about 3 feet or so with an excavator and then backfilled that with wood chips. They then place a silt layer on top of the downstream part of this bioreactor and then put some gravel here. And they create a little riffle dam of cobbles and pebbles that just impede the flow of surface water, which causes the water to build up slightly. That creates a hydraulic gradient that forces the water down through the gravel, through the wood chips, and into a collection pipe, and then there's an outlet right here. So no pumps, it all works based on gravity, and you can adjust the residence time within the wood chips just by raising or lowering the level of the outlet to get greater or less residence time. Here's just an image of that with an excavator, and that arrow is showing you the direction that surface water is flowing within this drainage, and you can see them placing some of the wood chip media and then putting some little filter fabric over it. And so here's the gravel that's overlying that, and they'll continue placing the gravel from here to about here, along with a silt layer from here down to around here. And sorry, that's what it looks like when it's all finished. And so here's that that little gravel riffle dam, which causes the water levels to build up here, which forces it down through the wood chip media down here to the outlet pipe. And that's the outlet pipe. So simple, no pumps. The farmers on this field, they can adjust the level just if they see water overtopping the dam. They can lower the level of the pipe just so that they increase the hydraulic gradient through the wood chip media. The results are pretty impressive, and this case study has been published in the Journal of Groundwater. I'm happy to provide that. But it shows it was installed in 2005, and there's monitoring data from then to the present, and flow rates of about 5 to 10 gallons per minute, and a reduction in nitrate concentrations of about 50% from about 30 milligrams per liter of nitrate down to about 15 milligrams per liter. If you need more treatment, you could have these surface water reactors in series or just create longer units. The thing about them, too, is that they are pretty simple. No pumps, no electricity, and this one that I'm showing you was installed in about a day at a cost of about $3,000. Questions about the longevity of the wood chips. Here's 8-year-old wood chips that have been in the ground, and they look, for all intents and purposes, just like they did when they were emplaced, and they can be locally sourced. So it's a sustainable technology. And then different variations of these with collection drains and more centralized bioreactors. This technology can also be applied in a reactive barrier or a trench filled with these wood chips. And this is especially attractive in the Chesapeake Bay and Cape Cod area. This consultant, Lombardo Associates, is installing these riparian biofilters right along the interface between groundwater and surface water around Cape Cod to treat the nitrate as it's discharging to those waterways right along Cape Cod. Here's a graphic of that with high concentrations of nitrate entering the reactive barrier, and then down gradient they've been knocked down 60 to 70%. That's just a simple graphic with concentrations versus distance, but the real compelling figure is this one, where you can see right at this interface the location of this trench, and so this wood chip media goes down about 15 or 17 feet, groundwater containing nitrate, and at this site it's emanating from a septic tank, flows through that reactive barrier, but what don't you see here? You don't see the algae. So this is an area that is the downgradient flow path from this simple wood chip reactive barrier with no algae that you see here and you see here. So that's just an overview. This idea, the wood chip reactive barrier material is becoming popular in different parts of the country. I think it's certainly applicable here in the Central Coast. And there's variations of this, but my goal is to try to develop a case study for both the groundwater and surface water environment in the Central Coast by the end of 2012. And we're working with this Canadian university and also UC Davis to try to develop one of these, at least a couple of these case studies. So that's my personal goal. Our firm also provides more traditional consulting services that I think are valuable to growers. We've been mostly focusing on industrial clients with industrial stormwater and surface water issues, but we're all learning, and we see some great opportunities helping growers and the agricultural community. So thanks very much.
What's in the bioreactor?
It's just wood chips.
Okay. It's just so it's no different than what's in the trench.
Yeah, it's the same stuff. It's basically a permeable source of carbon that just dissolves very slowly over a period of decades, And as long as it's not exposed to oxygen, it really stays intact and it doesn't decompose very rapidly. So it just dissolves very slowly, giving off enough of the carbon to react with the nitrate to where it's converted to nitrogen gas.
What kind of wood chip?
Pretty much anything except cedar. I've heard redwood isn't so good. We have a project now in the Mecca Valley in Saudi Arabia, and we're looking at using ground-up palm trees. So that seems to be quite reactive also.
Did you say redwood work?
Redwood's not so good. So.
What about pine?
Pine works great, and most hardwoods work fine. And I guess it's cedar that has just a natural antibiotics right. that just...
Yeah. Redwood as well.
Right. So, you know, for sustainable technologies, locally derived organic material are really very, very usable. So, low cost, no pumps, no electricity, minimal monitoring if possible, and, you know, having somebody on site be able to raise and lower that outlet just based on their observations of the conditions.
Do you have designs for a certain amount of acreage of discharge, acre feet of discharge that needs to be so long, so deep?
Yeah, exactly. And so as long as there's an estimate of the concentrations and the water flow rates, either the surface water or groundwater flow rates, then you can design you can configure them to get the required level of treatment. And we've got some good spreadsheets for that and can... We're generating some kind of generic cost estimates for different types of configurations.
What about riverbeds and creek beds that are carrying nitrates? How do you handle that?
Probably that first design that I described to you, where you just excavate a little bit of the stream bed materials and backfill that with the wood chips, and then create a system that forces the water to go down and flow through that. That wood chip media, so that would be appropriate. So especially in agricultural settings, drainages, tailwater receiving drainages is a good application for this. Maybe right upstream from the Oso Flaco Dam would be a good test site. So we're very interested in working with the agricultural community and conservation districts and any others, universities, just to further explore this and get a couple of good case studies here in the Central Coast.
Well, have you got any demonstration projects in the Central Coast?
Not yet. I'd like to change that.
Okay. Any questions? Well, just a quick one. Could you back up two slides, please, Murray? You've got a note there that says to note. It's a log scale, but I don't think you mentioned that, and that makes that more impressive in terms
yeah.
of the efficiency
with
of the
reduction,
results.
Yeah.
So the you have it's concentration, right?
Right.
And so you went from what to what? It's like
I think
7 or so.
Yeah, it's about I think here it's about 8 or 9 milligrams per liter of nitrate is nitrate, and then down to it's below. 0.1 milligram per liter.
Right.
So that's
being a log scale, that's pretty dramatic.
Right. And that can be adjusted. The treatment can be adjusted by lengthening or thickening the flow through distance of the reactive barrier. I would like to mention too, the slide is courtesy of Lombardo Associates. They're a firm in Massachusetts, and I think they've given presentations here to some to the regional board in the past. And the community about the applicability of this for some of the nitrate issues along the coast.
For groundwater, how deep can you go with the treatment?
You can go quite deep, but it just gets more difficult and more more challenging. The sweet spot is like 10 to 20 feet, which is the limit of some of the excavators. Although we have talked with City of Morro Bay and Tim Cleath and others, that narrows area just east of Morro Bay seems like it could be very attractive for a reactive barrier, but the depths are 60 to 70 feet and would probably require a different technology like caissons of these reactive materials. So we have installed reactive barriers to depths of 200 feet at industrial sites, and it does get more complicated and more expensive. If you're able to do it within the range of excavators down to 20 feet or so, it's much less expensive. So understanding the depth of contamination is pretty important.
Right.
That's where the assessment comes in.
How about lining ponds with this type of material?
Yes, I think for treatment in ponds, it's also being used, and I can get you more information on that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next presenter is Keith Backman.
Good afternoon. I'm Keith Backman, Della Valle Laboratory. I'm a certified crop advisor and have a lot of different positions within the certified cropping program and things of the sort. So I thought I'd mention nitrogen and the environment and how a crop advisor or certified agronomist can help out from that standpoint. I think it's been mentioned here, I think everyone's familiar with the disadvantage of having nitrate in the drinking water or in any fashion where people will drink it. You know, it ties up hemoglobin, causes blue baby syndrome, some other things, and tends to mimic some of the problems associated with carbon monoxide in the blood system. The good situation that people sometimes don't address is that we need nitrate to survive, in that we can't eat it. It's a problem for us to eat or drink, but plants require it to survive. In the laboratory, and we do a lot of lab work, I should have stated that, in the Regional Water Quality Control Board Area 5. We work with hundreds of dairies and do a lot of groundwater monitoring, environmental monitoring. I'm also a distribution operator for testing drinking waters and drinking water sources up and down the valley. But the situation is nitrate is taken up by the root system to convert and made into protein. In the laboratory, you run a leaf test for nitrogen, multiply it by 6.25, and that is the protein. So if a farmer grows 30 tons of corn, he gets just about exactly twice the nitrogen removal than if he grew 15 tons of corn. So that corn takes the nitrate and converts it to protein, which we need to live. So we can't live without nitrate. The corn can't live without nitrate, et cetera, and other crops. So the problem has been for decades or many years in the past, back in the day, if people had a crop that required 200 pounds of nitrogen, the farmer would arbitrarily put on 300. Of course, he didn't know that it was 200. It might be 250, it might be 200, 225 that it needs, but 300 worked, so he'd put it on. So the extra 100 pounds just washes into the water table. And after, you know, as you all know, it doesn't change fast. It goes into the water table, and maybe a generation later, when his son takes over the farm, now he's got this 100 pounds coming back to haunt him. Well, the problem is he's still putting on the 300 pounds on a crop that uses 200 because that's what his daddy always did. And it works. Can't argue with it working. And so what happens is it gets bigger, and those nitrates tend to rise uniformly over the long term, and that's how we all got into this situation from the agricultural standpoint. Same thing applies to septic systems, city, municipal waste treatment plants, people's lawns. You know, not many people in here, I'm sure, take a leaf analysis to determine how much triple 16 to spread on their lawn. They should, but it's not going to happen. They put on, well, I put mine on, or this person puts theirs on three times a year, twice a year. Well, they're guessing, too. One of the things that's interesting about corn that we fit in the nutrient management programs in the San Joaquin Valley, I'm just using corn just as an example because it's on every desk constantly over there, is that a strong corn crop easily pulls out 300 pounds of nitrogen to the acre. Because what we have to do to verify, the verification on the involved nutrient plans over there, is we have to analyze the corn in the laboratory, weigh it, grind it up, have the trucks weighed, and we know exactly how much nitrogen exited the field, and that's related to how much N is applied, which is what you're looking at in your Tier 3 situation, I believe. So, or something like that. And so the nitrogen exits the field. Well, 300 pounds of nitrogen from an acre is a lot of nitrogen. If that were ammonium sulfate, 21%, that's 1,500 pounds. that's more than you can carry in a truck unless it's a three-quarter ton truck. Under the standard F-150, that's a pickup and a half full of fertilizer from 1 acre, which is about the size of 4 residential lots together, 2 houses and 2 houses. So it's an amazing, agriculture is an amazing filter system. You can pull out massive amounts. The farms in the valley that double crop grain and corn can pull out 600 because the grain in the winter silage will pull out 250 to 300. So double that, 3,000 pounds of fertilizer converted to protein. Now, if they don't have a dairy, they got to come in with that truckload and a half of fertilizer to do it. So it's an amazing filter system. It's converted into green. It's converted into protein. It's converted into food. Anywhere else, now switching hats, when we do water quality testing for schools and small water systems and things of the sort, and if they run high levels, people say, gee, should I put in an RO system, reverse osmosis purification, or should my ranch have that? Well, the health departments are shying away from that because now you create a concentrated brine that you have to dispose of. Now you have a toxic waste problem. And the average person, if it's a small rural house, puts it in his drain in the kitchen sink, it goes down into a septic system, and now it just goes straight down towards his well and under his house. So they're discouraging that. Anytime you concentrate something like nitrogen and don't let it go to a plant, it's got to be dealt with somewhere. And go into the air, that procedure that he was just talking about would be acceptable. But other than that, it's going to be going in the environment or it's going to be going in the ocean. There's going to be problems with that. So agriculture is the only way to do an immediate beneficial reuse, and it's very effective. And you can screen hundreds and hundreds of pounds to the acre very effectively. So the most economic way to do it is to accurately measure your requirements for a plan. If you have a crop that uses 200 pounds and 100 is coming from the well water source, then you give it 100 and the difference comes from the water, and you just cleaned the water of nitrate and made it green. You put it into the crop, it's hauled away, it's converted to protein. And really, that, as far as I know, that's the only green solution that there is, other than just relocating a toxin to some other department, you know, sending it to the ocean or putting it in the air. And if you put it in the spray program, like with a dairy waste pond, Air Board gets involved. They don't want it there. PM2.5 and the ammonia particles gets involved. So just that is laying some groundwork in what we need to do. The first thing you need to do is identify the problem. Bring it down. Don't put any extra on. If you just switch so you only put on as much as the crop need, you're getting there, and the groundwater won't get any worse. I've dealt with farms in the citrus area on the northern Tulare County that we've cut back, and I have numerous farmers don't put any nitrogen at all because of the well water. And nearby, we do groundwater monitoring wells, and we've watched them over the last decade or so slowly come down. So it can happen, but it's generation time-wise. But if we don't start now, you know, if we do the same thing granddad did and our dad did, it's going to be going up. But we can change it. It won't happen yesterday, and I know some people say that it's, you know, it's slow. Yes, it is. It's a generation's worth in many cases, unless you're shallow wells or gravel packs or something like that, which react faster. Regarding certified crop advisors or certified professionals to do this, some of the questions that I understand have been brought up is, are there enough? Well, there's a lot of agriculturists in the area with a moderate amount, either a basic amount or a lot of expertise, but they've never been challenged to get a specific certification. You know, this one maybe went to Cal Poly, this one Fresno State, this one Colorado State. But how do you find that on a board or a mat to find out how many there are? When the Region 5 nutrient management plans came into effect, there were 135 certified crop advisors in the whole state. That's about the time I went on the board. As of today, there's 494. So as soon as there was a need, these people with an education, oh, we need a certificate. They went in, challenged the, or took the course. It's almost a full-day board exam to take it. And the numbers have gone up. And so there's a big increasing number. There haven't been many in this area that have gone to get that certification, taken the board exam, though there are a lot of agriculturalists. So in this area, there was only Salinas to Oxnard, there was only a very small number. But there's two annual testing dates a year. One of them is the first Friday in February, one the first Friday in August. That's nationwide for the CCA program and internationally. And from this area, there are 75 taking it tomorrow. That is a lot of people who stepped forward and said, you know, I've got the certification to handle that. So there's a huge number in the number of people. Most of the fertilizer companies in this area are making it a job requirement. So every person out there with a fertilizer delivery tag will have a document that indicates that he's certified to handle that. Now, some of the guys aren't involved for the heavy involved programs take a lot of time, a lot of math, and your average fertilizer salesman already has a full-time job. But they can be advisory to the grower. They can spot the grower and he's got a problem. On your tier one and tier two levels, or low and medium levels of nitrogen threat, from what I understand reading the documentation, a certified professional does not have to write and sign off a program. But the farmers quite often tend to get confused. If he puts on 250 pounds of UN32% material, 100 pounds of triple 16, some diammonium phosphate, figuring out from each of those how many pounds and how much nitrogen in it, it's a little more than most farmers can do, and if you ask them to do it, they usually screw it up. So I would put in the documentation that they would be strongly suggested to have their numbers double-checked by a CCA, such as their fertilizer salesman, who, like I said, many of them are going past, but just a certified professional to double-check the numbers. The farmer can do all the work himself, and they can do it over coffee, over the breakfast table probably, depending on the size of the farm. Some will be moving, I'm sure, into getting CCAs on farm as well. So I think that is very justified. The more involved people in the Tier 3 high nitrogen situation, I understand there's going to be a reduced number of farms that will be targeted. The high threat polluters, I'm not sure what the term is, they will involve probably a higher degree of oversight and people that specialize in nutrient management. In the San Joaquin Valley, the certified crop advisors have a standard procedure and a nutrient management program designed for dairies, where they had to go through and test and do a lot of exam time and calculations on figuring some of those out. But to do a nutrient management program to help a grower solve the problem, he needs two bits of information, or his certified crop advisor would need it. He needs to know how much nitrogen is in the field already when he's starting. You know, if he knows his strawberries need 250 pounds, and I know that's another subject, but if he's got an anticipated nutrient requirement, he needs to know whether he's got 100 pounds in there or zero to start with. If he guesses wrong, he may have a crop loss, but he's just going to have to know to start with. And if he has a potential of a high nitrogen source in his well water, he needs to know that. And from those two numbers, you apply the difference. Not rocket science, not real difficult. I've been consulting in the San Joaquin Valley for 35 years. And cotton growers for many years, just an average run-of-the-mill cotton grower will always take a soil sample first and take four tissue samples during the season, so they're applying it as needed. Models won't work because if it rains or the weather changes, the amount you might need this particular month might be different, so they run tests.
What does it cost for the farmer to do that, to take his soil samples and some leaf samples?
We run for a situation like that where you break the property into like 40-acre units and we do all the work. It's $7 or $8 an acre a year, so not enormous. And there's a lot of farmers who do that.
And that's having someone else do the sampling?
But they can always cut that down. I mean, a typical soil analysis might be $50. A typical tissue analysis is less than that if he wants to bag them and send them in.
And you do that, the smallest land unit is an acre, or is it 40 acres?
It depends on the area. 40 acres can be, you can do it off of one plant if you felt if there was enough tissue to do it. But that's per unit.
Yeah, if you have 40 acres.
Could be 80, could be 3 acres.
If you have 40 acres, how do you know if you just do one plant?
Oh, no, you do a composite. You take leaves off.
Okay.
You need about,
okay.
Typically, 30 leaves or petioles, stem, depending on the crop. And someone walks through and zigzags and takes a representative area of the field. And that represents whether he needs a little more, he's a little too high, or not. You don't. farming, you never want to put the whole amount you anticipate out at the beginning of the season. You want to put a starter amount and then fine-tune it from there. And that's just standard agricultural practices. It's done constantly up and down the regions. Many of the commodities in agriculture tend to be risky if you get too much nitrogen on. Get 10 pounds too much nitrogen, your wine grapes are going to be second rate. Almonds and hull rot comes in. Or table grapes, and they don't color and don't ripen. So most of the commodities will test accurately, put a certain amount on, and do follow-up. The indeterminate varieties, the ones that are harvested green, like a broccoli and things of the sort, there is not necessarily any way to tell whether you put on 50% too much if you don't test it. And also, there's no reason to think you did it wrong, so they don't bother testing it. And so it's something that is pretty rare in the industry. There are areas around here. I think there are good farmers that do it. There are ones who probably ignore the numbers and guess. There are, a lot of farmers will call up their fertilizer guy, and he will come in and help dispense 100 pounds to the acre. Some other farmers will get a 10,000-gallon tank at the beginning of the year and just have his guys, go put some more on. They don't even have meters. They don't know how much they're applying. They're guessing. They just fill up the tank and run it out there. And there's going to be people who don't want to be asked to even check how much liquid fertilizer to put out, because they're going to put a meter in, and that's pain. And that's where, again, someone certified that works for the fertilizer company or someone else will be a value in the system. Are there enough CCAs to do the job? Like I said, there's a lot of them coming up right now. They have some abilities out there that had never been documented. Certified Crop Advisors are not a membership program. They're a subset of the American Society of Agronomy, but it's really a certification, sort of like a driver's license. You've passed this, you've got this ability, and that's what that indicates from that standpoint. And that's sort of my presentation initially, if you've got any questions.
The Tulare County experience with the citrus, what kinds of reductions in nitrate and groundwater have you seen over time?
I was looking at some groundwater monitoring wells that we've been watching with an engineering firm, and I would probably 30% over 7 or 8 years.
And do you know what the levels were, the numbers?
I'd be guessing. I could get you some information or pass it, but I would say they were probably around 15 or so in their milligrams per kilogram or parts per million. They're probably down below 10 in that ballpark.
If you could get that to our staff, I'd like to take a look at it.
I'll see if I can get permission from the client to do it.
Okay.
And or leave the name off. But
okay. Right.
But it can work.
Yeah. Any questions for us? No? David? Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Briggs, do we have more on this?
Yes. Cards.
Okay. Card. Okay. I have two cards. Darlene Din and Kevin Merrill.
They've been enough for more. There's more coming.
More coming. Okay.
Being advertised.
Good afternoon. I'm going to stay with my prepared statement, even though I have high concerns with the testimony that has been given. An ag order must be designed with an achievable objective on technical services. My concern is the lack of professionals able to meet the ag order. The staff report indicates there is currently many professionals available to meet the needs of all the individual farming operations on the Central Coast. I disagree. The professional standards to assist a grower or landowner in the staff's approach for compliance, to name a few, will involve understanding new legal requirements, technical understanding of both inputs and management effectiveness, environmental science, water quality standards, food safety requirements, along with other regulatory requirements placed on farming operations. The regulated community has to make farming decisions in a holistic manner using science and applying the art of farming for adaptive management. Staff has stated in the past that the only objective they are concerned with is the farming operations meet the water quality standards set forth in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The challenge for the operators is every governmental agency has standards. The complexity of those standards will require professionals to get up to speed to fulfill all of the regulations. How will many of these individuals have the knowledge and the needs for the ag order? How will they understand the liability and the responsibility placed on them to assist in the new ag order? Will there be professionals that see a business opportunity and seek out ag to offer their services? That's obvious. That's my note from today's presentation. I believe so, but there will be a lag time in this process. Another consideration along with that is the agencies and private sector that currently do provide technical assistance have also nonprofits who have seen significant reduction in staff levels and decrease in availability of training in wake of economic setbacks. Successful implementation of operational improvements needed to improve water quality will take time and substantial expertise. Please take that into your consideration. And as a personal note of the public, I'd really appreciate somebody speak to you on a technical matter that is a researcher from an academia to offset those that would potentially be able to have a niche business. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Merrill? And then David Corta? Costa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had not planned on speaking on this item until I heard the last speaker. And I got to say, I'm really surprised by what he told you. You know, we have a modern progressive industry here along the Central Coast for agriculture. The picture that Mr. Bachman was painting you maybe was in the 1950s or so of taking a tank of fertilizer out there and turning on and letting it go. I don't know any grower on the Central Coast region from San Mateo County to southern Santa Barbara County that operates in that manner. This is a sophisticated industry that uses all the things he talked about, patio samples, soil samples, all the things that go along with that. We don't have the production we have here without doing those things. So to stand here, I just couldn't listen to painting a picture of agriculture in and maybe that went on in the 1950s, but it certainly does not happen here, and that is not, I don't think, a fair representation of agriculture here today. Thank you.
And, you know, Mr. Merrill, I didn't take his comments as criticizing the Central Coast growers at all and insinuating that they do or don't do certain things. That's just the way I received his information.
Well, as a grower from the Central Coast, I did.
That's all right.
But I just, but so I'm, you know, I'm, just so you know.
But I'm kind of the audience somewhat for this, and I didn't take it one way or the other, just as information.
Because all the things he mentioned, we do. I mean, I would think 95% of the agriculturists here do the things that he was talking about. And we rely on professionals to help us with nutrient management plans and those things. So I just wanted to let you know that that's not exactly the case.
These 95%, do they determine how much nitrogen they do need to apply?
Absolutely.
Okay. And are they using a certified crop advisor to do that or some other?
In some cases they do, or they'll use a certified or a PCA to do it. Or they'll hire a lab, like a, well, people use fruit growers' labs and send their stuff down to them, and we get that analyzed and use it from our PCAs. It's far more advanced than I think that presentation gave the impression of.
Right. How about his cost estimate for getting samples done? Is that in
the think the costs are probably close. Okay. I mean, I don't think that the costs are prohibitive for people from doing it. I think we do them all the time.
Right.
My point was to tell you that we do those things already, and they're already being done.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. David Costa.
Thank you, Chairman Young and board members and staff. I hadn't planned on speaking on this subject either, but there's a couple points that I wanted to speak to. If you could think back to the May meeting here in San Luis, I talked about the complexity of our farm operation and what I thought was reflective of, you know, many farm operations in cool season vegetable production areas like we're in. I talked about our average ranch sizes, our average block sizes, the number of individual plantings we make in a year. For our operation, totals about 1,400. The average size of those plantings is about 8 acres. So it gets complex. I mean, I hear a number, you know, testing once every 40 acres. There's a lot more breakdowns and individuality to everything that we're doing. The small ranches, the small blocks, the number of individual plantings, and the variability of the soils, you know, within those small fields. A lot of it may be determined by river floodplains of, you know, centuries past, where we have two or three different soil types within a field, so that all of a sudden that one soil sample isn't representative. You know, it takes more specific sampling. The I shared with you also a program that we use and several others that somebody's doing for us with nitrate quick tests, trying to measure carryover nitrogen between crops to make decisions for the second crop in our you know, double crop system during the season. Also measuring pre-side dress nitrogen. And maybe I'm just getting taken, you know, in terms of what we're paying for, but the service that we're using is costing us $20 an acre for that program through the season on the blocks that we're sampling and the recommendations that we're getting. There's no question that there's a rush to get certified as a certified crop advisor. I mean, I've been told that by one of the certified crop advisors that I know. It was always his stance coming into this that there weren't enough of those in existence. He said there definitely is a rush. His point is, I mean, or my point would be, does that mean, you know, that they're qualified? I understand they pass a test and they're certified. How much different might that be than a rush of people to get a driver's license that pass a driver's test? Does it mean that they're a good driver as soon as they get on the road? You still have all the experience factors that have to come into play. And it isn't, you know, just a little part-time job that somebody's going to pop in and see you for a few minutes a day and make a recommendation and be on their way. I mean, this is going to be a highly interactive, you know, need that it's going to take more than just, you know, I think several dozen certified crop advisors that you're going to be aligning with. And the last point I had had to do with, it was interesting to hear the speaker talk about the other region, Region 5, because I understood that he was talking about the nitrogen balance ratio and, you know, what you're taking off versus what you're going to put in. I understood that in Region 5, the nitrogen balance ratio was 1.4, and I see it proposed in this draft as 1.0 on crops in rotation and 1.2 on annual crops. And I understand how you measure what's in the soil and what you expect to take off of the crop, and you apply the difference. And I didn't see where Mother Nature came into play in terms of rainfall and leaching, taking some of that you expected to have available for your crop.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Last speaker is Kay Mercer.
Hello, I'm Kay Mercer, and I didn't anticipate speaking today either. I have a BS in agronomy with a specialty in range management. I have a master's in weed science. Also, that's an agronomy degree. I'm a pest control advisor, and I could be a CCA if I took the test. So I'm qualified to stand up here and talk about these issues. And I've worked all over the country. I started out walking cornfields in West Kansas and Texas, and I have worked all over California. One of the things that I find really interesting with people that come from a corn cropping system is they come into this area and they think they have the answers. This is a very unique area. These are very unique crops. The crops that are, I call crops at risk based upon the proposed conditional ag waiver, are extremely complicated. And I think that the information that was presented today was oversimplified for these crops. The growers in this area There are omissions in the record. I'm currently writing an article called The Challenges of Developing Environmental Mitigations, and I'm going back through the record to see what have growers told you, the regional board, that they're doing. And they haven't told you enough of what they're doing. So I think some of the presentations that are being made, the staff are trying to backfill those omissions. But the consequence is you're being told information that maybe isn't entirely accurate. I'm not saying that the facts that were given, well, some of them I would question, are not correct, but they did not reflect the care and what growers are actually doing. And the record doesn't reflect that. Now, there's some things that are going on. I wish we had the kind of nutrient guidelines that the corn crop has. I wish we had that for the 200 crops that are grown on the Central Coast. We don't. Strawberries. The nutrient guideline for strawberries is 100 to 400 pounds per acre. That's the guideline. Why? Because they grow different varieties. They start in San Diego with one variety, and they as the season warms up, they move further and further north. Well, each variety had a different crop requirement. It had a different nutrient guideline. Not the crop, the variety itself. We see the same thing in lettuce. We see the same thing in all the little Chinese vegetables. This is, you know, to say, oh, this is the way they do it in corn, that doesn't apply. It does not apply. I know I'm out of time. On the bioreactor, great idea. Does not have to be limited to wood chips. It's the kind of thing that the coalition wanted to do, but we were so busy being accountable for our grants, we had no time to do any of those kinds of positive tests. So thank you very much.
Okay, let me just ask you a couple of questions,
okay,
if I can. Isn't the process that the prior speaker was describing accurate in terms of testing, you know, the content and getting a level of nitrogen?
Not necessarily. There are crops on the Central Coast where there's huge debate within that commodity among very qualified individuals about the merits of tissue testing. There's not one crop that where people dispute the merits of soil testing. There's not one crop. However, like I said, what is a factor of one? What is a factor of 140%? If the experts haven't been able to come up with a guideline for a crop, what's your baseline for that? You know, it's nonsensical. There's also debate about, I'm not a soils scientist, but there's a lot of debate about the bioavailability of nitrate that is in irrigation water. Is it even 100% bioavailable? There's huge debate within the soil science community about that. So it's not a direct, oh, we have 40 pounds in our irrigation water, therefore you can subtract 40 pounds from your nutrient budget. It doesn't really necessarily work that way. You know, soil science, the reason I'm not a soil scientist is because it's so complicated and so hard. And doesn't mean that I can't be a CCA. I am definitely qualified to be a CCA. I'm self-employed now. The reason I'm not is I'm not sure I want to have to interface with your staff. It's the bottom line. And I think there's a lot of people that are standing here going, the process has been so acrimonious, the staff has displayed such blatant hostility to ag, why would I put myself in that position as a professional?
Okay. Thank you for your
comment. Any other questions?
Dave? No.
Okay.
Thank you.
I had a question for Kevin.
You do? Okay.
Can I make another statement?
Sure.
I was instructed not to try to give a PhD class here on nutrient management, so I just picked corn as an example. Actually, I don't work with the corn. I do work with corn. But we do a lot of crops, or we do multiple samples, and a lot of farmers do that, and I think I explained that we work with a lot of farmers that do a soil analysis, put on a starter amount of soil, and then put on as-needed applications after that, and it may be sampling every 2 weeks, et cetera. Someone asked me today if there was a computer model to tell me how to tell them how to fertilize a crop. No. Everything changes. Every variety is different. Every day of weather is different. So the only way to fine-tune it to the edge has always been, and I think that was alluded to here, you start out with a good estimate of nitrogen, and then you meter it out and put it that way. Didn't do that 50 years ago. That's how we got here. But the best way to bring it down is to do accurate monitoring, multiple tests as the plant progresses and as it uses it. So that was the intent of that statement. And I know we work with a lot of farm. We work with vegetable growers that will pull 5 and 6 tissue samples or quick tests and things of the sort. There's ways to do it. It's a pain in the neck. And, of course, I work for a testing lab. We make fertilizer recommendations constantly. There's a lot of people out there that do that, and that's their profession. So to be able to fine-tune it and show you that there are ag professionals out there that can do it, and, that kind of work's available. I'm not trying to minimize anyone. All of our clients work accurately with tissue analysis and soil analysis and things of the sort. So there's good procedures. It just it just needs to be watched closely. A lot of them, I don't know if they've read the Tier 1 and Tier 2 requirements. They're doing more testing than are going to be required in that already. And the gentleman that spoke before me, I don't know if he knows that, but he's already doing more testing than is required on some of the information. Just thought I'd mention that. I didn't mean to minimize anybody. We work with a lot of people that do wonderful jobs.
Thank you. Mr. Merrill, Mr. Briggs had a question for you.
Hey, Kevin, it seems like we get this difference of perception quite a bit. And you mentioned you just estimated that 95% of the growers are using these kinds of practices and testing and fine tuning and all that, and it seems like that doesn't square with. And by the way, Darlene Din said we should have somebody from academia to balance things out. So speaking of academia, the UC Extension did the lettuce plots. Was it Tim Hart's? Pardon?
Mike Bacon.
Was it Michael Kahn?
Or maybe both.
Both. I think it was both. Anyway, and so I'm going from somewhat faulty memory, but it seemed to me that they basically cut the fertilizer application in half for the lettuce plots that they had in the Salinas Valley. They reduced the irrigation applications by a third. Check for yields. They not only got the same yields as the control, but they actually had increased yields on 2 out of the 3 plots. Again, going from memory. So, and as I recall from their write-up, they were using the reduction because they were saying this is the comp, this 200 pounds per acre or whatever it was, is what's commonly used in the Salinas Valley, and that's somebody from academia. So, that should be an informed opinion. And then it doesn't seem like it squares with your saying 95% of the farmers are doing this testing for fine-tuning. And so you see the difficulty in trying to reconcile those things?
Well, I think that agriculture tries to use the best technology that's out there. And if they did an experiment out there in Salinas on lettuce and they found that you can get away with less nitrogen, and I think that could be proven all the way along, like with different soils or different water quality, whatever you have, then I think that would follow through. I think that message would get through. I think my point was that farmers are looking for the best technology that's out there to do it. And if there's a new study out there that says that you can apply 100 units of nitrogen versus 200 and come up with the same yield. I'm not sure that's right, but I'm sure somebody would try it, because you got to remember, those guys are there to make money. Nitrogen's expensive, and you don't want to put on any more nitrogen than you have to. If you can get the same yield with 100 units of nitrogen than 200, that's just more money in your pocket to do that. So I think the point of my comment was that I think agriculture is trying to do its best to remain at the cutting edge of technology. And if they're not out there standing with a tank of fertilizer driven up to the field and the gate is open and the fertilizer goes down the ditch, that's the impression I got sitting out there. That's why I said that, what I did. I think that most farmers today have to use the best technology.
Right.
Or they've got a business.
I was just trying to get that difference in perception of, and that study is not the only time we've gotten that kind of information about, well, if a little's good, more is better, that sort of a thing. So it's at odds with your portrayal of a 95% rate of fine-tuning.
Well, I don't think it's at odds with it, Roger. I think that if that information's available, I think you'll see farmers use it. If that's something new that comes along, and it may be, I don't know how long that test went. It was for 1 year, one crop. Maybe it did work for one planting of lettuce, but will it work for five plantings of lettuce or 10 or mm-hmm. whatever? But I think my point is that farmers are anxious to follow whatever the lead is in the new technology. That's my point.
You grow grapes, right?
Yes. But I've grown all kinds of things. I've grown tomatoes, sugar beets, grain, oranges, all kinds of things. So don't put me into grape
deal.
Although at least you can enjoy the grapes at the end of the day more than you can some cauliflower.
That's getting in the last word. There you go.
Okay.
Thanks.
Anything more on this item?
I think that's it.
Okay. We can now move to item 20.
And thanks.